Welcome to Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz, the only program willing to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. Your host and guide to victory over communism is one of the nation's most experienced national security journalists, Bill Gertz, who uses unique facts, pinpoint analysis, and exclusive interviews to identify and counter today's destructive communist ideologies. Now, Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.
Welcome to the podcast. This episode marks the second season of Victory Over Communism. I've been doing the podcast for a year now, and I believe it is a very important educational tool that is shining a light on Chinese communism and American Marxist ideologies. As I like to note in the beginning of each podcast, this program is about ideology. It's not about people. In America, everyone is free to believe in whatever they choose. The purpose of the program is to expose the fallacies of Marxism-Leninism and its ideological offshoots by explaining in clear and easy-to-understand terms why these ideologies are wrong. Not only are they wrong, but communism throughout its history since the early 1900s has caused untold suffering from its tyranny and mass deaths. This program is dedicated to the lives of those scores of millions of people who lost their lives because of the inhuman ideology of communism. For this episode, I'm taking on an emerging ideological threat, radical transgenderism. Recently, several violent incidents involving people who claimed to be a different sex took place. The most significant was a verbal and physical assault on Riley Gaines, a former college swimmer, at San Francisco State University, where she was speaking out against the practice of allowing male athletes to compete in women's sports as transgender females. A transgender murderer, then, Audrey Hale, killed six people at a Christian school in Nashville, including three children, before being shot dead by police. Hale had previously identified himself as Aiden. Days later, a transgender teen, William Whitworth, who goes by the name Lily, was arrested for plotting to conduct a mass shooting at three schools. Whitworth had written a manifesto and was in possession of a copy of Karl Marx's The Communist Manifesto, the ideological blueprint for anti-capitalist communist revolution. These cases are examples of an emerging phenomenon that is being called radical transgender Marxism. Transgenderism is a mental disorder that recently was recategorized not as a disorder, but as a gender dysphoria, considered less than a mental disorder, but nonetheless a condition of emotional distress. What appears to be taking place is that transgender people are becoming increasingly violent and radicalized in pursuit of what they claim is, quote, liberation from normal society that for millennia recognized a fundamental scientific fact, that is, that there are only two sexes, male and female. The idea of ideological Marxism combined with radical transgenderism was outlined in an edited book published in 2021 by two transgender Marxists, Jules Joanne Gleason and L. O'Rourke. Gleason is a writer, comedian, and a historian, and an online biography states that the author published essays in various online outlets and performed internationally at a wide range of communist events. L. O'Rourke is a self-described gender theorist and founder of the online publication New Socialist, a Marxist and leftist political outlet. Gleason and O'Rourke state in Transgender Marxism that transgender culture has popularized itself to an extent previous generations of Western gender subversives could have barely imagined. Quote, what had once been strictly clandestine or otherwise associated with political radicalism has now been embraced outside its niche constituency. Transgender culture has increasingly appeared as a mass culture, they wrote. As such, we might expect to see a dwindling of trans politics as a subversive force. Instead, transgender communism has bloomed, with revolutionary movements around the world often enough being led by those whose lives have been reshaped around the notion of transition from sex. Key issues for these Marxists are anti-prison, anti-police, and anti-poverty struggles, averting ecological collapse, and in alignment with the crypto-fascist Antifa organization, which has been documented to include significant numbers of transgender radicals, these Marxists are making new inroads to advance their cause of revolution against the established American system. Transgender Marxism is not the traditional anti-capitalist ideology of Karl Marx, but a bastardization of Marxism adopted by those advocating for eliminating all male-female sex distinctions. Gleason and O'Rourke argue that so many transgenders are drawn to Marxism and revolutionary theory in general because of their view of oppression, their perception that they are oppressed. Transgender life, they say, is harsh enough that many are easily led to conclude that the conditions are beyond redemption, that no center-left party or third-sector trend can be relied upon as truly loosen the grip of their oppression. Thus, the emergence of what they call gender-deviant Marxist thought in pursuit of social revolution and the application of historical materialism to their sex. Quote, "Our struggle for political emancipation," the authors say, "has become understood as one progression within a broader process of class war, and our transitions as reshaping the demands of social reproduction." They call transgender radicals vulgar Marxists or improper Marxists, operating outside traditional Marxist ideological parameters. But they also seek formalized equality despite setbacks during the Trump administration. The radicals do not support the mainstream transgenderism that is showing itself in support from President Biden and in sports and business, most recently with the controversial Bud Light beer putting the image of a male claiming to be a woman on its cans. The radicals find inspiration for their revolution in different aspects of Marxist practice. Some seek the use of research to critique the capitalist social system. Others use Marx's philosophical teachings that were rapidly anti-Christian and anti-religion. Still others adopt Marx's propaganda and political organizing skills. Key to our agenda is assuring that trans life itself comes clearly into view. We are opposed to the entrenchment of a transcendent principle of trans that comes to obscure the particular struggles of trans people to survive in the face of capitalism, the authors state. The book goes on to say that transgenders are often found in prostitution and in the technology sector areas that are not sympathetic to traditional labor organizing that has been a target of traditional Marxist revolutionaries. The authors believe capitalism dominates gender relations and that sexual identity is central to history, as in Marx's false theory of historical materialism. The idea that history is marching toward an ideal workers' paradise. Sexual identification for these radicals is not static, but constantly revolutionized by transformations in how we organize society collectively, according to the authors. Thus, the acronym for the sexual deviancy continues to expand. Once limited to homosexuals or gay and lesbian, the ever-growing acronym is now LGBTIQA+, which stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, queer, questioning, asexual, plus, and other terms like non-binary and pansexual. Just as critical race theory has become a radicalized form of Marxism, transgenderism is now becoming a sexualized form of Marxism. Investigative journalist Joshua Peters sees these Marxist derivatives as Marxian, not truly Marxist in terms of ideology. Peters calls these derivatives critical Marxism. That is an attempt to salvage Marxism after the realization that the ideology, as practiced in places like the Soviet Union and now China, are anti-human. True Marxists are mainly located in university faculty lounges, with their derivative seen as neo-Marxism. Authentic Marxist communists are aligned with Karl Marx's writing linked to the early views of the German philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, as reflected in the Communist Manifesto. Marxism is a failed social ideology. Even a more charitable view of it, critical Marxism, as a critique of social structures and institutions, would still not save it, Peters said. Its biggest prophecy and claim to the end of history failed to realize capitalism's capacity for self-correction as a function of the market and social forces, he added. Marx's ideas are authoritarian and ignore individual well-being, a key reason the Bolshevik Revolution under Vladimir Lenin and the Cultural Revolution under Mao were features of totalitarian regimes and produced authoritarian leadership in both of those nations. As Tucker Carlson stated recently on the violent transgender movement, it is a new quasi-religion that Americans, in particular, are being forced to accept by the government. Converts to this false faith abandon their old lives and embrace an entirely new identity. Their former identities no longer exist. They become dead names. But here's the one big difference. Transgenderists do not believe in the God of monotheism. They believe that they themselves are God, with the power to control nature. And if you think about it, this should be a concern because it's a recipe for extremism. People who believe that they're God tend to react very badly when told that they're not God. So, if you're running the government and you wanted to prevent violence in your own country, you would be very concerned about the growth of this quasi-religion of transgenderism. The Biden administration has been cheering on this violent-prone group. That was clear at the White House press secretary voicing support not for the victims in Nashville at a Christian school, but of the transgender murderer. This is not the message that should be sent to pseudo-religious extremists with weapons. The transgender movement has been committing acts of violence for years at rates much higher than those in the general population. Some examples. Last year, a trans girl tried to assassinate Justice Brett Kavanaugh at his home. Another self-described non-binary shooter murdered five people at a Colorado nightclub. In 2019, a trans teenager shot nine people in a high school, killing one in Denver. In 2018, a mentally ill transgenderist killed four people at a Rite Aid distribution center in Aberdeen, Maryland. As Carlson notes, mental illness leads to violence, and there's no mental illness greater than the delusion that you are God. In a sense, transgenderists are attacking the most basic understanding of the nature of God, that God created humans in his image, and that his image is male and female. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File, that's GertzFile.com, or at the book site called DeceivingTheSky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to GoFundMe.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to GoFundMe.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. This is the counterproposal section of the podcast, what I call the spiritual portion. The VOC worldview is based on the spiritual teachings of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, who brought a new understanding of God and the universe and a deeper understanding of God's providence of history as a returning of fallen humans back to God. In the last episode, I talked about the two dimensions of human life, the physical and the spiritual self. Each of us, I noted, do not pass into the spiritual world at the time of physical death. Instead, we are continuously living in both realms, spiritual and physical, in the course of our physical lives. Our spiritual selves are joined with physical bodies until the physical body separates from the spiritual self at the time of physical death. At that point, the spiritual self becomes independent and lives on in the spiritual world for eternity. This is completely at odds with the atheist and materialist view of life espoused by Marxists and communists, who view humankind as limited solely to the physical realm and being no different than animals. Once we clearly know this truth about the true nature of life, communism will cease to be of any interest. So, I'm now going to address the growth of the spiritual self. As I mentioned, humans' earthly life is the primary opportunity for the spiritual self to grow to maturity or perfection. But what is the mechanism of this spiritual growth? To learn something about the principles of spiritual growth, first consider the process of physical growth. The physical body, like the physical body of any other living thing, requires a period of growth to reach maturity. During this growth period, certain elements are consumed by the body. They include air and sunlight from above, as well as food and water from below. In the same way, the spiritual self also needs to pass through a growth period in order to achieve maturity. Each of us must know just what sort of elements are needed for spiritual growth to take place. In general, individuals must receive truth and love from their parent God. These correspond to air and sunlight for the physical growth process. That is, they are given freely from outside the individual. We call these spiritual elements life elements. God is the ultimate source of all life elements, and we receive them through our parents and other parental figures. Just as physical food is essential for the growth of the physical body, the development of the spirit also requires a similar spiritual food. This is called the vitality element. It is generated by our own physical bodies when we practice truth and love in our daily lives. In other words, the spiritual self must have give and take with God by receiving God's truth and love and must pass on these elements of inspiration to the physical body. The physical body receives the message and obeys it and practices the truth and love of God in real life. In this way, the physical self can return abundant vitality elements to the spiritual self, by which the spiritual self then grows. Humans must receive God's truth and love while on earth and practice it. In this way, humans become an embodiment of the truth and love of God. That is the only way one's spiritual self can grow to full maturity. Humans must practice God's greatest commandment to love God and fellow people. This alone can provide for the eternal well-being of an individual. This is the important purpose of the physical stage of life. You need to realize that the material well-being of the physical body is actually of secondary importance when compared to our proper spiritual development. When a person is totally blind to the reality of God and His truth and love and lives a selfish and greedy life on earth, that person has completely denied the growth of their spiritual self. In the words of Jesus, "What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul?" In the VOC worldview, every action of a person has eternal impact. What each of us does has an eternal effect on our spiritual well-being. This is reflected in the Bible saying, "You shall reap what you sow." Whatever situation a person may encounter, it does no good to blame others. Humans have no one to blame but themselves, and each person must take responsibility to live a good and moral life. Communism, by contrast, is out to destroy both family and religion. On the surface, communism appears to be asking people to sacrifice themselves for a perceived unselfish ideal. It would then seem to be spiritually beneficial to humans. This, however, is extremely misleading. In reality, communism stifles human spiritual development. It denies the existence of God and denies God's truth and love. The greatest injury done by communism is that it totally blocks out humankind's spiritual life by teaching that there is no God and no eternal spirit. Instead of love and sacrifice, the essence of life becomes hate and resentment for communists. If you study Marxist literature, it's clear that at the very core of Marxism is resentment. To promote the dialectic, the ideology of communism, of Marxism, promotes hatred, and this hate withers and destroys the human spirit. Here again, a strong contrast can be made with the communist view. Communism denies the most sacred institution of all, the family, thus denying humans the experience of the practice of love. By breaking apart families and encouraging children to betray their own parents, they have engendered such hatred and animosity that millions of people have come to deny their eternal life and be stillborn into the eternal world of love. This is the worst crime which the God-denying ideology of communism commits against humanity. Communism destroys the family. This is a point Marx declared very clearly in the Communist Manifesto. Bright children are routinely separated from children. They are taught that the party and the state are more important than their parents. Prosecuting one's parents for ideological crimes is regarded as heroic action in communist states such as China and North Korea. Communist propaganda glorifies a youth who turned his parents into security police for stealing a small amount of rice because they were starving during a communist-produced famine. The parents were executed and statues raised to the young child as an exemplar of communist morality. Consider the words of Richard Wurmbrand, who spent 17 years in a communist prison in Romania. He said, "I came to understand the power of evil when I spent time in prison. I began to see that there must be a devil, because it would be impossible for men to treat other men the way that I saw people treat people in that prison in Romania." Something happens when people are taught to hate in that way. They become capable of doing anything to advance their cause. State interest becomes the moral justification for their crimes. Ultimately, the love of God is cut off, and actions, instead of being motivated by love, by concern, or by ethical ideals, become to be motivated by hatred. The result is spiritual death. In the words of Jesus, "Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell." That was in Matthew 10:28. This is exactly what communism does. This blanket denial of spirituality can be compared to a blackout. Communism represents a spiritual blackout which today affects billions of lives. It denies the eternal well-being of people. Besides the physical atrocities which have destroyed tens of millions of people, communism has ruined the eternal lives of billions more. This is why communism is really the worst crime ever perpetrated against humanity. Here we find the reason why. In the name of God and in the name of humanity, communism must be stopped. This is the fundamental concern of the VOC worldview. When we see that there is a philosophy today that is destroying the spiritual dimension of human beings, then we must stand up, we have to oppose it, we have to stop it. Right now, the most seriously ideological threat is the danger posed by Chinese communism. Xi Jinping has made clear his goal is nothing short of world domination under communist ideology. To achieve that, the Chinese communists are aggressively working to undermine, weaken, and ultimately destroy the United States, the main impediment to Chinese world domination. Our ideological fight cannot be satisfied with saying, well, we're going to stay where we are. We can have, they can have their part of the world and we can have our part of the world. We don't need to worry about it. If we have real compassion, if we really feel that all the people on earth are our brothers and sisters, and if we really feel that we have an eternal life, then we cannot allow millions of people to die spiritually because of a false ideology. Compassion calls us to action. Over 80 years ago, people were fleeing Nazi Germany. And amid all those people, there was one German living in New York and teaching at the Union Theological Seminary who said, I have to go back to Germany. I know everyone else is running. I know I'm well here in America, but I have to go back to Germany. I can't stay here. And the reason he went back is that he felt God's call. He said there are two kinds of grace. There is cheap grace, the kind of grace that invites us to say, I'm well, I don't have to worry about others. But he said that through his prayers and efforts, he had found another kind of grace, which he referred to as costly grace. And he spoke about the cost of discipleship, the cost of real belief in God. He said that it was this belief which mandated that he return to Germany, even at the cost of his life, and do everything in his power to stop Nazism. The man's name was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was arrested in 1941 by the German police. Shortly before the fall of Adolf Hitler in 1945, he was executed because of his opposition to the Nazi government. Bonhoeffer's life is an example for us. He recognized that the real value is the eternal spiritual value. His earthly life has ended, as each person's must, but he lives on in the eternal spiritual world in a greater capacity and in the hearts of all those who admire his actions. In the eyes of God, he's not dead at all. His noble life goes on forever. Today, we must think about the liberation of the communist world. When Reverend Moon came to America in 1973, he announced that he wanted to have a rally in Washington, D.C., to awaken the American people to the danger of communism. And in 1976, he held that rally. Then he said, now I want to have a freedom rally in Moscow. And that is the spirit behind the VOC worldview. The mission is to bring liberation to the communist world. Our challenge today is to bring freedom and liberation to the people of China, where 1.4 billion people are under the yoke of Marxist-Leninist ideology. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters.
Welcome back. This is the news section of the podcast where I look at stories related to communism and Marxist ideologies. This episode explores the ideological drive by Black Lives Matter Marxists to undermine the traditional nuclear family. It's based on an article published by the pro-liberty group called the Foundation for Economic Education in September 2020. It revealed that the organization Black Lives Matter that year removed from its website a page that condemned what it termed the Western prescribed nuclear family structure. The reporter for the piece, John Miltimore, went to the BLM website and found that the reference to subverting the traditional family had been removed. But using the internet archiving tool, the Wayback Machine, he was able to resurrect the anti-family posture that had been a key feature of Marxists going back a century and a half. The passage on the family had been listed under the section called What We Believe that contains several policy positions not related to the main objectives of the Black Lives Matter group called on defunding police departments. The removed section stated, we disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and, quote, villages that collectively care for one another, especially our children, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. Additionally, the activist group, several of whose leaders describe themselves as Marxist revolutionaries, also back what they term queer-affirming networks. They want to end also what they call heteronormative thinking, described as the belief that the world is heterosexual. Another example of Marxist ideology applied to radical sexual politics. The ideological approach to undermining the traditional family goes back to Marx and Engels. BLM exists in two forms, a formal organization known as Black Lives Matter and another less formal movement known as also calls itself Black Lives Matter. The latter is a leftist movement, while the first group, the formal Black Lives Matter organization, is dominated by Marxist revolutionaries that are ideologically driven toward overthrowing the U.S. system based on their anti-capitalist ideology. That BLM was co-founded by Patrice Couleurs, Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, who are rooted in Marxism. "We actually do have an ideological framework," Couleurs said in 2015. "We are trained Marxists. We are super versed on, sort of, ideological theories." Karl Marx's anti-capitalist ideology that seeks to abolish private property as a goal also seeks to abolish the traditional family. And this was disclosed in the Communist Manifesto, which is a kind of Marxist-Leninist Bible for communists. Abolition of the family, even the most radical flare-up at this infamous proposal of the communists, Marx stated. On what foundation is the present family, the bourgeois family, based? On capital, on private gain. In its completely developed form, this family exists only among the bourgeoisie. The communist theorists then compared the nuclear family to public prostitution, then asserted that it was natural and desirable for the institution to, quote, vanish. The reference to prostitution would no doubt upset the current transgender Marxists who note that sex workers disproportionately are transgender, along with technology sector workers. The bourgeoisie family will vanish as a matter of course when its complement vanishes, and both will vanish with the vanishing of capital, Marx and Engels wrote. The bourgeois claptrap about the family and education, about the hallowed correlation of parents and child, becomes all the more disgusting, the more, by the action of the modern industry. All the family ties among the proletarians are torn asunder, and their children transformed into simple articles of commerce and instruments of labor. Marx's hostility to the family is based on his view that the modern family is linked to slavery and serfdom and related to agricultural services. It contains a miniature of all the contradictions which later extend throughout society and its state, Marx said. Once communists took power in Russia, the Bolsheviks launched a decades-long policy of abolishing marriage and weakening the traditional family. Harvard historian Lauren Kaminsky wrote that the issue was so central to the Bolsheviks that they published decrees establishing civil marriage and divorce soon after the 1917 October Revolution. These first steps were intended to replace Russia's family laws with a new legal framework that sought to encourage more egalitarian sexual and social relations. A 1926 article from The Atlantic magazine, written by a woman living in Russia at the time, told of how the term illegitimate children had been abolished and a law passed allowing couples to divorce in a matter of few minutes. Legislation also was introduced eliminating distinctions between legal wives and mistresses, including granting property rights to unmarried consorts. "Chaos was the result," the Russian woman said. "Men took to changing wives with the same zest which they displayed in consumption of the recently restored 40% vodka." In China, about 50 years later, the Chinese Communist Party showed off its own version of state-enforced family structure in its One China policy that lasted from 1979 to 2015 and included policies of forced abortions for those that had more than one child. It was the most extreme population planning policy in world history. Today, the Chinese have reversed course as their population is declining sharply, and the communists are urging people to have more children. On universities in China, government signs and edicts once prohibited students from getting into relations. Now, signs are encouraging it. In the past, students could be expelled from school for having sexual relations. Recently, one sign said, "Take advantage of your youth and experience the joy of falling in love." It was Chinese Communist founder Mao Zedong who first explained the party's role in managing family procreation. Quote, Reproduction needs to be planned. In my view, humankind is completely incapable of managing itself, Mao said. It was plans for production in factories, for producing cloth, tables and chairs, and steel, but there was no plan for producing humans. This is anachronism. No governing, no organization, and no rules. The aversion to the traditional family remains strong among socialists. A 2019 article in the left-wing publication The Nation bore the title, "Want to Dismantle Capitalism? Abolish the Family." The piece offered a glimpse of the modern socialist critique of the family. We know that the nuclear private household is where the overwhelming majority of abuse can happen, the author wrote, and then there's the whole question of what it is for. Training us up to be workers, training us to be inhabitants of a binary, gendered, and racially stratified system, training us not to be queer. Socialism demands collective control of resources, and humans, to them, are the ultimate resource. This is why the traditional nuclear family that places authority in the hands of parents rather than the community is an affront to so many socialists. As stated in earlier podcasts, the VOC worldview regards the family as central to God's creation. It reflects God's characteristics of masculine and feminine, and it's essential to ultimately restoring fallen humans back to their original ideal. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz. Featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
I spoke to you earlier about my book, Deceiving the Sky. I also wanted to urge you to take a look at another book that I wrote called iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. We live in an information age, and yet we're getting bombarded with enemy propaganda coming at us from all different directions. iWar really helps expose what we need to do and how we need to counter it. I urge you to get a copy. The book can be found at iwarbook.com or at my website, thegertzfile.com.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz. Featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by William Lay, a lawyer in New York and a key person in developing what I'm now calling the VOC worldview. Bill worked for many years with a group called CAUSA that waged a relentless ideological war against communism in the 1980s. He was one of several experts who took part in developing the CAUSA manual in the mid-1980s, an updated variant of that manual focusing on the dual ideological threats from Chinese communism and American Marxism is key to what I've been using for the counterproposal sections of this VOC podcast. It's an essential text for the VOC worldview. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
Tell me a little bit about the context of developing the CAUSA manual and what kind of work was involved in producing it.
Yeah, you know, to kind of get a feeling for what CAUSA was all about, I mean, you have to remember the situation in the late 1970s when things looked grim. I mean, with Cuban troops being used as Soviet surrogates in various places, and, you know, one country after another in Central America being heavily influenced by Marxist groups, if not taken over, as Nicaragua was. And it was in that situation in the late 70s that, CAUSA was assembled. And the theory, the understanding we had was that, you know, while some people are not very interested in theory and not very interested in philosophy and, you know, are just willing to pick up a gun and fight for because they're angry. Really, communist revolutionary movements are based on an ideological worldview, a philosophical worldview. And it's a kind of a deviant offshoot of Hegelianism. that mm-hmm. says that progress can only come through conflict. And of course, it's enhanced by, enhanced by Marx's view of history, seeing everything as class struggle, everything as economic struggle. And so what we did in CAUSA is, we developed an ideological or philosophical critique. We also, by the way, our goal was not to promote corrupt anti-communist regimes. Mm-hmm. Our goal was we wanted to encourage real democratic development. So we also did a critique of some of the failures of the Western system, which are, they're more failures in practice than they are in ideology. But we did that as well.
Yeah. And how was it received? You did quite a lot of work in Latin America and then in the United States. How were people reacting and responding to the CAUSA manual and CAUSA worldview?
Well, we did a large number of conferences, both in South America, especially in Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Brazil. And we got an enthusiastic response from people who knew there was a problem. They knew there was a problem and they wanted some support in dealing with it. Mm-hmm. But we also got a lot of buy-in from people who hadn't really looked at the problem that way. They weren't so focused on, let's say, philosophical underpinnings of free government or mm-hmm. The importance actually of faith and the very much anti-religious component of Marxism. So we got I would say in South America we were, and don't forget that people had been subjected to the Carter administration one-sided human rights policy. Mm-hmm. which critiqued anti-communist regimes and not communist regimes. So yeah. We were like a breath of fresh air, giving them some kind of support, encouragement. Our seminars down there were well attended, well received. People were taking our materials home. And I know you mentioned earlier the manual. We mm-hmm. put together an instruction manual called the CAUSA Lecture Manual. People were buying the slides in those days and mm-hmm. taking the manual and giving the lectures themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really excellent. The manual really, I was so amazed. It really goes in depth in looking at the fallacies of Marxism-Leninism. I mean, in a way that's easy to understand and also important for people to get a full understanding. And then the counter proposal, which is a faith-based Judeo-Christian one based on the teachings of Reverend Sam Yung Moon. And that, to me, is so powerful when you juxtapose the facts about God's providence versus historical materialism, which says, as you mentioned, that all progress comes through struggle, and the counterproposal says, no, it's through cooperation. It really was a tremendous bit of work. How about in the U.S.? How well was the CAUSA worldview accepted in the U.S.?
Well, we also got a great reception in the U.S. I have to say, the people who were most, happy with CAUSA were people who already knew the problem. Mm-hmm. There was just nobody doing anything about it. And then we appeared and, we pulled people together. We basically brought together a lot of the leaders in that area. We also educated a very large number of state legislators. That was one program that we had. We had an outreach to retired military. We had an outreach to state legislators. We had an outreach to clergy. That's also very important because of the inroads that leftist thinking and Marxism have made, even into the churches. Mm-hmm. So we had a CAUSA ministerial alliance. We also, as I said, we had an outreach to retired military. Most of these people, they were not comfortable with communism, but they hadn't necessarily gone down to the roots of it. It was very enlightening for most of them to see what the theory underneath communism was, and how that, you know, how Lenin, of course, built on Marxism, particularly with his theory of imperialism, and how, you know, that enabled, let's say, what should have been an antiquated 19th century theory to survive and to become significant in the 20th century. So this was all, you know, this was all illuminating to people, even those kind of people, even the military people and so forth. And it was very well received. And, you know, if I might add, you know, you mentioned Reverend Moon. It's ironic that at this time he was being hounded by the U.S. government because of a lot of misunderstanding. And he ended up being incarcerated on tax charges. Now, I have spoken on this topic extensively, the injustice that took place there. But he read the Kauza Manual while he was incarcerated at Danbury Prison, and he gave us comments on how to improve the manual.
Wow.
I always thought that was quite amazing.
That's great. Yeah. You know, after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, there was kind of a relief and kind of almost a retrenchment, and kind of people thought, well, this is the end of the Cold War, and the communism is finished. Now we're seeing kind of a resurgence, especially through communist China and domestically through kind of a neo-Marxism. How do you see the problem of communism and Marxism today?
Well, I know you're doing a lot of work in this area, Bill. Obviously, we still have communist states. They're not the Soviet Union. They're different. Mm-hmm. They're variations. But we still have communist China. We still have North Korea. We need to understand them. And I know you've done more than anybody, really. But along with a lot of other people, in helping us understand how, you know, Marxist ideology continues to inform the Communist Party of China. And they've made their variations on it. It certainly continues to inform North Korea, although they've had their variations from the get-go. I mean, you know, we're not going to see the old Soviet Union back again. But nevertheless, the Marxist approach toward things is still very much with us. You know, the view of everything as class struggle, even the American Revolution can be characterized as a class struggle event or an economic event, or maybe, you know, we got all these variations of sort of race-based theory in terms of reinterpreting American history. So that whole way of looking at things, we're still contending with. And, Roger Kimball did this wonderful book called The Long March, where he talks about the march of Marxism through all of our institutions. And we still need to, deal with that and the after effects of that.
Yeah, I know Roger well. He was the publisher of my book, Deceiving the Sky. Last question to finish up here. In your view, what do you think needs to be done to better educate people about Chinese communism and American neo-Marxism?
Well, I mean, I like your podcast, Bill, but it's got to reach more people. And I'm not quite sure. I mean, maybe we need, maybe the Kauza approach needs to be reinvigorated. People are curious about the great questions of life, right? People like to feel that what they're doing is connected with big ideas and big purposes. And Marxism, communism was able to harness that in a wrong direction. I mean, I still feel that that needs to be dealt with systematically, and people need to be inspired to see, you know, their own, their individual efforts, their family efforts, U.S. policy and everything else as moving in a really good direction.
Great. We've been talking with William Lay. He's a lawyer in New York and took part in developing the CAUSA worldview, which is key to the VOC podcast. Bill, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Bill.
And that's it for this episode of VOC, Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz. Please tune in again in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for listening to Victory Over Communism with award-winning national security journalist Bill Gertz, the only program in the free world unafraid to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how the Communist Party of China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. See you next time on Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.